Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
At this very moment, state actors worldwide are fundamentally rewriting the rules of global power projection through highly advanced asymmetric strategies. From the deployment of ultra-long-range strike drones in Eastern Europe to complex cyber fraud operations funding naval expansion in East Asia, the traditional boundaries of warfare are rapidly dissolving. This operational shift demands a complete reassessment of how modern militaries disrupt logistics, bypass defenses, and secure strategic leverage across multiple domains.
Yeah, so to really unpack all of that, we are doing a deep dive into a pretty dense stack of recent intelligence updates from the Institute for the Study of War. These cover reporting out of Russia, Iran, China, Taiwan, and North Korea. And we're also pulling from a newly translated Chinese Military Journal article provided by the U.S. Naval War College. So the mission for this deep dive is to basically synthesize these reports, you know, figure out the mechanisms these state actors are using to outmaneuver their adversaries.
Exactly, because we are looking at a wave of these asymmetric strategies. I mean, from laptop farms funding literal warships to 3,000-kilometer drone strikes to highly formalized stealth hunting kill chains, it's a lot to cover.
It is. So let's start with Eastern Europe. Because distance, which, you know, used to be the ultimate defense in warfare, is essentially being erased right now. Yeah. The intelligence reports detail a massive shift away from that grinding trench warfare and toward deep strategic strikes by Ukraine.
Yeah, the mid-June ISW reports, they track a really significant expansion of Ukraine's intermediate and long-range strike campaigns. They are basically bypassing the front lines entirely to hit high-value targets deep within Russian territory.
Right.
Like, for example, they recently struck the Moscow oil refinery, twice in a matter of days, actually. But structurally, the more significant target was the Dubna Space Communications Center.
And looking at the map, I mean, Dubna is, it's like 540 kilometers away from the Ukrainian border.
Yeah.
So what makes a space communications center so critical to a ground war?
Well, Dubna is a major satellite teleport. It's a massive ground hub that connects satellite data with terrestrial military networks. So in modern warfare, taking out a node like that degrades the adversary's ability to communicate, to navigate, and to guide their own munitions.
Wow.
It really proves that raw geographic distance is no longer the shield the Russian military command relied upon.
So how are they pulling off strikes at that range? I mean, the sources indicate Ukraine is fielding these new, what are they called, Firepoint drones.
Yes. The ISW confirms these Firepoint drones have demonstrated a range of 2,070 kilometers.
That's insane.
And Ukrainian leadership stated they are scaling that capability to reach up to 3,000 kilometers.
Which just puts an enormous amount of infrastructure in the crosshairs. But, you know, the strikes aren't just about reaching deep into Russia. They're also methodically choking off the immediate logistical routes to occupied Crimea. The reports mention targeting ground lines of communication. Unpack what that actually means on the ground.
Sure. Ground lines of communication, or GLOCs, are simply the physical pathways. So roads, rails, bridges used to supply military forces. I mean, warfare is fundamentally an exercise in logistics.
Right.
And Ukraine has been systematically hitting the Henichesk and Chanhar bridges, the transport ferries at the port of Kavkaz, and the TES Terminal 1 oil depot. If you take out the bridges and ferries, the transport trucks can't move.
And if you take out the oil depot, the trucks have no fuel anyway.
Exactly. The whole system stalls.
And you can see the immediate ripple effects in the civilian sector, right? The ISW details severe gasoline shortages across Russia and occupied Crimea. The ferry operations in Crimea had to be fully suspended. And get this, they've even shut down children's summer camps because the local infrastructure just can't support them anymore.
Yeah, it creates an excruciating strategic dilemma for Russia. They're already suffering from a shortage of interceptors for their air defense networks. According to the ISW, Russia has actually been forced to pull Panzer air defense systems directly from the active front lines to defend Moscow.
Just so we're clear on the hardware here, what exactly is a Panzer system?
It's a highly sophisticated short-to-medium-range surface-to-air missile and anti-aircraft artillery system. It's literally designed to travel with ground troops and protect forward operating bases.
Okay.
But Russia is mounting these tactical battlefield systems onto elevated towers in Moscow to protect their oil refineries and command centers.
So it's like a boxer dropping his guard to protect a cut on his face. Doesn't that just guarantee the body's going to take a massive hit? I mean, is this strategy actually working, or is it just a temporary logistical headache that Russia can adapt to?
It creates vulnerabilities that can be exploited, absolutely. I mean, while a state can adapt to logistical headaches, like the ISW noted, Russia is attempting to import gasoline from Asian partners to offset the refinery strikes. You cannot simply import or manufacture advanced air defense systems overnight.
Right, that takes time.
Every panzer pulled back to the capital is a gaping hole in the frontline defense. It forces the military into a reactive posture, constantly choosing between protecting the home front or the war front.
And that physical exhaustion of defenses we're seeing in Ukraine, it perfectly mirrors the diplomatic exhaustion of alliances happening in the Middle East. Because Iran is currently engineering a strategic dilemma of its own for the U.S., but they're doing it at the negotiating table.
The ISW special reports from mid-June detail these quadrilateral talks taking place in Switzerland. The U.S. and Iran are attempting to negotiate a peace memorandum of understanding, an MOU, with Qatar and Pakistan mediating.
But Iran's approach to these talks is fascinating. They are weaponizing the actual sequencing of the agreement. They are demanding that the U.S. force Israel to fully withdraw from Lebanon before Iran will even agree to discuss its own nuclear program.
Right. And simultaneously, Iran is attempting to front-load all of the economic relief. The Iranian central bank governor was actually dispatched to Switzerland specifically to work on unfreezing $6 billion currently held in Qatar.
Wait, if Iran is demanding a total Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon as a precondition, they know the U.S. cannot unilaterally snap its fingers and force a sovereign nation to do that. So aren't they deliberately setting an impossible bar just to glow up the talks by time to enrich more uranium and try to secure that $6 billion up front?
Well, that aligns closely with the analytical consensus the ISW points toward. By setting conditions that the U.S. simply cannot guarantee, Iran designs a scenario where it wins either way.
How so?
If the U.S. somehow delivers, Iran secures a massive strategic victory for its proxy, Hezbollah, in Lebanon. But if the U.S. fails, Iran can blame Washington for the collapse of the diplomacy, providing diplomatic cover to continue advancing its nuclear program.
Like holding the menu hostage until the chef pays you. And to make sure that leverage hurts, they are turning up the heat outside the negotiating room. The reports note Iran publicly announced the closure of the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, and even if that threat is partially just informational posture, the mere announcement creates panic in the energy markets. The goal is to spike global oil prices, which applies immense domestic and economic pressure on U.S. leadership, particularly during an election cycle.
But the leverage isn't just economic, right? They are evolving how they use proxy militias. The ISW cites sources reporting that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, has established completely new covert Iraqi militia cells. But why spin up new cells when they already have a massive network of established proxy groups in the region?
It is entirely about plausible deniability. The established militia groups are heavily monitored. So by creating new, highly loyal, compartmentalized cells specifically tasked with attacking Gulf countries that host U.S. forces, Iran can apply kinetic pressure while shielding its known assets.
I see.
The established groups can truthfully claim they aren't involved, which mitigates the risk of direct retaliation, but Iran still achieves its goal of regional intimidation.
It's like setting up a violent shell company. You get all the leverage, but none of the legal liability.
Exactly.
Now, while Iran embraces chaos and plausible deniability to gain leverage, China's taking the exact opposite approach. They are heavily formalizing their strategies to secure absolute control over their regional environment.
Which brings us to a highly revealing translation provided by the U.S. Naval War College's China Maritime Studies Institute. It is a Chinese military journal article detailing the People's Liberation Army's strategy for maritime, air, and missile defense.
Right. The document outlines what they call the four joint functions. And reading through the strategy, it's incredibly methodical. They detail creating a collaborative kill chain by pairing airborne early warning aircraft, AEW, with older fourth-generation fighters.
Yes.
But how does that actually work in practice? I mean, if you were going up against modern aircraft, how does pairing an older jet with a radar plane give you an advantage?
It is all about data sharing or sensor fusion. An AEW aircraft is essentially a massive flying radar dish. It can detect threats from hundreds of miles away, but it carries no weapons itself. A fourth-generation fighter is heavily armed, but has a much smaller radar footprint. So the PLA strategy links them together. The AEW plane spots the target, beams the targeting data directly to the fourth generation fire, and the fighter launches its missiles without ever having to turn on its own radar and give away its position.
Wow. And what's truly alarming is how they plan to use their own stealth technology within this network. Because the translation explicitly outlines a stealth versus stealth doctrine.
Right, and it's not what you might think. The PLA isn't planning to use their stealth fighters to dogfight other stealth fighters. The strategy advocates using stealth aircraft to quietly penetrate enemy air defenses, literally ignore the fighter jets, and hunt down the highly vulnerable refueling tankers, transport aircraft, and supply ships.
Which is brilliant in a terrifying way. They aren't going after the sword, they're going after the arm swinging it. If you take out the refueling tankers, an enemy's stealth fighters will just run out of gas and fall out of the sky.
It is a doctrine completely designed to sever the physical lines of force projection. And we are seeing the precursor to this kind of multi-domain preparation happening in the real world right now.
Right. The surveys.
Yeah. On June 18th, the ISW reported that a Chinese research ship, the Shangyang Hong 22, was actively surveying the waters east of Taiwan, heavily escorted by the China Coast Guard.
Beijing claims the ship is just gathering data on marine chemistry and, like, environmental conservation.
Yeah.
But if you look at where they are, those waters are near critical maritime choke points. Isn't this environmental survey really just a thinly veiled operation to map the seafloor for future submarine warfare? I mean, they're analyzing the structural integrity of the chessboard.
It is highly probable dual-use data. When you are planning for a potential blockade or a scenario involving submarine combat, you need hyper-accurate maps of the undersea domain.
Right.
You need to understand the thermoclines. Those are layers of water with different temperatures that can hide a submarine's acoustic signature. You need to know the salinity, the currents, the exact topography of the ocean floor. Gathering marine chemistry provides the exact data sets required to navigate and hide attack submarines.
And their preparation extends far beyond the physical environment, right? It includes a deep layer of human espionage. The reports detail a Taiwanese colonel who was recently impeached and sentenced to 11 years in prison for passing military secrets to a PRC intelligence network.
Yes, the espionage effort is completely globalized. The U.S. Department of Justice and the FBI recently seized 13 web domains operated by Chinese intelligence. They were creating completely fabricated consulting firms on LinkedIn to recruit Western military and government targets.
Using fake job postings to steal state secrets is a wild tactic, but it is actually the perfect pivot to our final theater. Because while China uses fake jobs for intelligence gathering, North Korea is using fake jobs for pure, unfiltered cash generation, specifically to fund a massive naval expansion.
Yeah, the ISW's June 23rd Korean Peninsula update highlights recent satellite imagery showing rapid expansion at North Korea's shipyards in Nampo and Cheongjin. The regime is actively building out a green water navy, a fleet capable of projecting force beyond their immediate coastlines.
They are currently constructing Cho Hyon-class guided missile destroyers with the stated goal of fielding 12 of them in the next 5 years. And state media announced plans to construct a massive 10,000-ton warship.
Which is huge.
It is. So the immediate question is, how does one of the most heavily sanctioned isolated economies on Earth afford to build 12 destroyers?
That brings us to a really remarkable report from the cybersecurity firm Nisos. They exposed a North Korean IT fraud cell consisting of just 22 members. Over a nine-month period, this small cell submitted over 166,000 applications for remote U.S. developer and IT jobs, coordinating the entire operation over Discord.
But if they are physically located in North Korea or even operating out of allied territory, how do they pass the background checks and get hired by a U.S. tech company without the IP address throwing up massive red flags?
They utilize what cybersecurity experts call laptop farms. The North Korean operatives recruit U.S. citizens, referring to them internally as natives, to act as the front-facing employee. The U.S. citizen passes the interview, gets hired, and receives the company laptop.
Huh.
The citizen then sets up that laptop in their own home in the U.S., essentially hosting a laptop farm.
Wait, so the North Korean coder remotely logs into the laptop, sitting in a living room in Ohio, does the coding work, and to the tech company's security software, it looks like the employee is just working from home in the Midwest.
Exactly. The paycheck clears into a U.S. bank account, the native takes a cut, and the bulk of the salary is funneled back to the regime. It is an incredibly sophisticated revenue stream that generates hundreds of millions of dollars, entirely bypassing global financial sanctions.
Okay, the hustle is undeniably brilliant. But let's look at what they're actually buying with that money. For a country with severely limited resources and highly questionable air defense capabilities, isn't a 10,000-ton warship just an incredibly expensive floating target? In a modern conflict, wouldn't that massive prestige project find itself at the bottom of the ocean very quickly?
From a purely tactical standpoint against a peer military, yes, a massive surface combatant is highly vulnerable. However, for Kim Jong-un, this naval expansion is primarily a political weapon. A 10,000-ton warship projects undeniable prestige and forces neighbors like South Korea and Japan to respect North Korean maritime boundaries.
That makes sense.
Furthermore, the ISW notes their long-term intention is to field nuclear missiles on that surface fleet. By moving nuclear capabilities to the ocean, they spread their deterrent across multiple domains, making it vastly harder for an adversary to neutralize in a first strike.
And they're doubling down on that nuclear status diplomatically, too. The ISW points out that North Korea flat out refuses to engage with any U.S. diplomatic outreach unless Washington fundamentally accepts Pyongyang as a legitimate nuclear state.
Right.
They're also deepening their media cooperation with Russia to globally legitimize that exact narrative.
Which really brings this entire analysis full circle. Every actor we've analyzed today is leveraging highly asymmetric, unconventional methods to achieve traditional, conventional power.
Yeah, if you step back and look at the whole board, it's staggering. We have remote IT laptop farms funding North Korean guided missile destroyers.
Mm.
We have Ukraine using 3,000-kilometer drones to physically exhaust Russia's air defenses.
Right.
We have Iran spinning up disposable proxy shell companies to hold peace talks hostage. And we have China mapping the ocean's thermoclines and building flying radar nets to hunt stealth bombers.
What unites all of these disparate theaters is rapid innovation. The traditional geopolitical advantages of immense size, favorable geography, and established military alliances are being actively subverted.
Yeah.
State actors are relentlessly searching for the cracks in the global system, whether that is a vulnerable logistics bridge, a legal loophole in international diplomacy, or an unverified remote job application, and they are driving a wedge right through it.
And looking at where this is all heading, there is one common thread buried in these reports that points directly to the future of conflict. The ISW sources mention that the PLA is heavily investing in studying how artificial intelligence will synthesize battlefield data. They believe the center of gravity in future wars won't be firepower, it will be data management.
Absolutely. The ability to process information faster than the adversary becomes the ultimate weapon.
So think about that as you go about your week. If algorithms are already powering the targeting of drones in Eastern Europe, fusing radar data for fighter jets over the Pacific, and automating 166,000 fake job applications to bypass global sanctions, will the next major global conflict be decided not by the military with the most troops or the biggest ships, but by the one with the superior data management algorithm?
The nation that can process the chaos of the modern battlefield faster will dictate the terms of victory.
The chessboard isn't just moving on its own anymore. It's alive, it's connected, and it's driven by code. It's a fascinating, if slightly terrifying, thought to leave you with. This concludes our operational deep dive for today. As the strategic landscape continues to fracture and evolve, maintaining a clear, factual understanding of these asymmetric threats remains our highest priority. Thank you for joining us.